Hello, everyone, and welcome to a very special confrontational, toxic potential interview with a best-selling author of a book where everyone is talking about, which is Don't Get Mad at the Penguins. I think it should be branded Don't Get Mad at the Fox. And we have here, obviously, we on the show, we interview some of the biggest billionaires, A-list celebrities, some of the most interesting people. And we have someone who's not only a fantastic author, which is great, but very more interesting enough. He used to be a former trial attorney. He's a phenomenal speaker. He has done stuff for companies like Groupon and Capital One and StockX. I mean, they're pretty much every big corporation out there, because here's the thing too. One of the biggest keys that kills organizations is drama, toxic environments, which the world is full of. And so we have Gabe Karp here. Welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you for having me. And it's great to be here.
So I'm going to start off with a couple of things you have on your website, 5 toxic traps of conflict. Okay. So I'm bringing up a couple of one because I don't know if I agree or not. There's something you call about the bully, right? And so growing up, I was bullied. I was a stutterer. People made fun of me my whole life. I always tell the story of someone was spitting on my locker and I caught them, and there was like 10 people spitting on my locker. Right. And I came up and was full of stuff. But in the business world, as you become more successful, not that I'm a bully, but I'm like, here's what I want. Here's what I need. Here's how it's go. And also, as you know, the world's number one wealth and business coach, I have a style where I would just call people out on their BS, right? So people comes in and they say, what are your numbers? I make 500,000. You're lying to me. It's a round number. What is it? They're like 498. I know you're lying because you didn't know. Like, so I'll go down a rabbit hole, and it's a strategy that I use to push people outside their comfort level, because there's two types of liars, conscious liars and subconscious liars. Conscious liars are lying on purpose. Subconscious is they tell themselves the same lie over and over, so they believe their own lie. So people might perceive in a negotiation times that I'm being a bully, but isn't it just about leverage? And so is my context correct, or am I just this toxic, you know, penguin?
Yeah, great question. I mean, look, the bully trap is not defined by a true bully, like playground type bully who's intending to bully people. That's not the trap. The trap is really when people are passionate, they have urgency, for whatever reason, they engage in bullying-like behavior. They don't intend to bully the other person. They want to know, is it 500,000? Is it 498? What's the number? So the approach of calling people out and being very direct, I love it. I prefer that.
But Gabe, isn't there a way of doing it? Like, people might say, well, the substance was correct, but the style was not. But the style, in a way, is what makes people uncomfortable, defensive, because I assume that, you know, just like when people go out of Shark Tank, they pitch. People are lying. I mean, they're just, what happens after the camera stopped rolling is it doesn't. So in a way, it's a strategy that really puts people on their toes. But to an outsider, if they were watching, if people know me, they'd be like, ah, that's just JT being JT. But that's why I don't post too many videos like that online, because to the naked eye, I would appear like a bully and, you know, a bad guy, which is not the case.
As you said before, it's style. You know, a lot of people have different styles. I've worked with people who just every other word, they're swearing, their volume is very high. But they do it in such a way where the people around them don't feel threatened. They don't feel bullied. They just feel like, this is his style. And some people are colorful with it, and they be funny and they're in their urgency.
But isn't it weak people though? Weak people who would say, oh my God, I'm being bullied. In a society we live in today, you're bullying me, you're mean.
It could be. It could be. It could be people that just don't have the constitution to withstand that kind of direct approach. Yeah. And listen, as a leader, given the younger generation, I could say that now, given the younger generation, there's a lot more of that. There's a lot more of that sensitivity of, you know, I feel like the way you're speaking to me right now is triggering me and that sort of thing. And I think the overall approach to that is if you deal with someone with respect and they feel the respect, you'll stay out of the bully trap. If you're disrespectful, people will feel disrespected, and that pulls you into a toxic thing.
Isn't bully though not defined? Like, correct people, the bully is just such a wide category. I'll give an example. Tom Coughlin, if you remember, was coach of the New York Giants, got them to a Super Bowl, maybe a couple. right? And known as the yeller and tough, and then went to Jacksonville and it didn't really work out. You know, and it seems the yeller, which is always yelling, will work for a short amount of time, the bully kind of part, and eventually it just falls on deaf ears, right? And it's not as effective over time.
Agreed. And I what really is going on is that if the way you're behaving is causing the other person or people to shut down and not communicate with you and hide things from you and maybe try to manipulate it around you, that's the trap. That is toxic behavior that was caused by the manner in which you're communicating because you're perceived as a bully. So the way to avoid that is, if you want to yell, by the way, people, I think people can yell all the time, as long as it's, if it's their style and that's what they're comfortable with, as long as they do things to make sure that the other people know it's like, I'm not like super angry at you. I'm not, you know, I'm not thinking about ways to physically hurt you. I have urgency. This is important.
But isn't it supposed to a leader supposed to adapt to the style? I mean, maybe it's different corporate versus the small business world or the business world, right? My company, I can do whatever I want. And a corporate environment probably doesn't sustain over time, you know, over that as well. Is there a difference between both?
For sure. As a leader, you have, if you want to lead people and have people follow you, and you're communicating in a way that are causing to not share information with you and talk about you behind your back, you're doing a bad job as a leader. And a lot oftentimes, and I've seen in a lot of cultures, in a lot of individuals in those cultures, engage in behavior that causes people to do those toxic things. That's the bad leadership. So yeah, you need to adapt. If what you're doing is causing that, don't do that. Do the thing that doesn't cause that.
Let me ask you, you're a former trial attorney, right? And so does the, not the bully, but we often take a look at A Few Good Men. Did you order the code red? You know, you got them right, I did. You know what I mean? Where that style, like there's different styles of attorneys, right? There's the one that's more like nice and stuff like that. But is, especially when the witness is not yours and the other side, does the sort of very tough kind of bully approach, not bully, but you're really pushing and hoping to get a reaction, which then people say things or do things, does that resonate very well with the jury? Or some jury will feel like, oh my God, you seem to be badgering this witness, even though you may be correct when your assessment. How's that work? And since you're a former trial, and is that different than business?
Yeah, I mean, the details matter. There's context here, but that, you know, it's all about what you can elicit. Whatever tool you use, you're not going to turn off the jury as long as you elicit the response from the witness that you want the jury to see. That is the most important thing.
But that's unknown. It's unknown.
Well,
you don't know, I mean, like how people are going to react. Like no one knew that. I mean, it is a movie that Jack Nicklaus would come up and just admit to it as well. But it's happened in cases, whatever, you're pushed over and people say something stupid or lash out as well. I don't know how much of that is Hollywood versus reality of trial.
Those dramatic moments like Jack Nicholson yelling at Tom Cruise, you're goddamn right, I did order the code red. Yeah. That's extremely rare. In my experience, and I think if you talk to any trial lawyer, you never talk to of a witness in front of a jury that you don't know the answer to for sure. Probably because you've already taken testimony from that witness months earlier to deposition. Or you've got a document proving wrong. You almost hope that they say the wrong thing. So then you can hold up, oh, well, have you seen what I have now marked as Exhibit A? You know, I think that but back to your question about taking this really aggressive approach to a witness. Sometimes that's an amazingly effective tool. If the witness is a bad person and you want to kind of let the jury feel like, yeah, we're getting, you know, we've seen this guy, he lies, he cheats, and here's this lawyer sort of, you know, speaking truth to power and shining a bright light on the lies, that can align a jury on a lawyer's side. I will tell you that in business, there are times when we've had, there used to be like the head of HR used to report up to me. And sometimes there were HR incidents that we needed to actually investigate and talk to people making accusations and the people against whom the accusations were being made. And I would sometimes be a little aggressive in those meetings because I wanted to more from them. I wanted to say more than what they were saying. I had a sense And oftentimes, and this is probably just from the training as a trial lawyer, you get a sense that the person is just not being totally open. So you get a little aggressive. And then, by the way, the most aggressive thing I've found is silence. If you got three or four people in a room and there's someone that's being questioned and you ask a question and they give you an answer and then you just stare at them and don't say anything and it's just dead silent, 99% of the people will start talking again and say more just to fill the silence. And that's usually where you get good.
But your personality, you're a very nice guy, right? You're a likable guy. I don't see you like you're a compromiser and use your, I mean, you don't come across as a, I'd say tough. I mean, your style is very nice and open and compromising and kind of like killing with kindness in a way and likability, which by the way, if people don't like you, they're not going to do business with you as well.
Right.
And so do you employ other sides? Because on the other side, your trap number two is a need to win, right? Which, by the way, you know, you say passion is the hallmark of execution. It drives us, keeps us focused, but sometimes a passion, a need to win becomes more important. Well, if I watch The Last Dance with Michael Jordan, or if I watch the documentary with Kobe Bryant, or you basically have my story, I hate losing more than I love winning, but, you know, I hate to lose, right? And so for me, winning is important. Now, it's not winning at all costs where I'll compromise my integrity or my ethics or my loyalty. Not that way, but it seems counterintuitive to some of the GOATs and the greatest of all time. You know, I've had, you know, Lionel Messi and Tom Brady, who I know, right? What's your favorite win? The one that you haven't won yet, right? Or Jack Nicklaus, when I had him over and interviewed him. And so it seems counterintuitive. So you clear to clarify about how the need to win is not, could be a toxic trait.
Sure. So I will say that, thank you for saying I seem like a nice guy. If you met me when I was deep in it as a trial lawyer and I did it for a decade, I probably was not as nice. I actually, having left that and then entering the world of business, I was surprised at how nice everybody was to each other. Consciously surprised, like, wow. So I think I've softened over the years. And my goal now is a trial where the goal to, you're creating conflict. You're getting into it and mixing it up. In business, I just wanted to resolve conflict so we could move faster. The need to win is a phenomenal driver of almost all progress, right? I mean, this any worthwhile human achievement.
Well, isn't it betterment though, progress? Like my definition of success is, am I a better person today than I was yesterday? Will I be a better person tomorrow than I was today if I become better? So better and winning are two different things. You can become better, you're still not winning.
That's a different goal. You know, you bring up The Last Dance, which is, I recommend anybody watch it, even if you don't like sports. It's so good. But there is a moment when
you must have liked the Detroit era part, and then it went after that. It just wasn't as good for you anymore. But there was two seasons where that it was good for you guys, Detroit.
The Bad Boys, the Bad Boys were
that's
just
toxic. That's toxic for you there. But they also won the championship. So it's kind of like, I'm not saying like Dennis Rodman was toxic, although, and I had Phil Jackson at my event. We could talk about that afterwards, right? But to have Phil there. To put a side note, I've been around a lot of people in the world and I've never been to the guy that is so hard to read. It'd be like, we'd be talking or on stage. I'm like, Phil, do you like me? He goes, do you want me to like you? Like you kept working so hard to want to please Phil, as if Phil Jackson was coach of the 11th championship that and I know why Kobe and Jordan were fighting so hard for the love and affection as well. But you have the Bad Boys, which is the year the Pistons won. As well, you have Dennis Rodman, who was a king of toxicity with the Bulls, of the environment that created and Phil trying to manage. And so your book is all about how like toxic, you know, being a toxic environment is so bad, which it is, but it seems in winning there's always conflict.
True. And so conflict and a never ending desire to win does not necessarily mean that you're in a toxic environment. You can, actually, those can be extremely healthy environments with very healthy conflict. If the desire is to win and your teammate is screwing up and you pull that person, I said, hey, like you're screwing up and you're screwing it up not only for you, but for the rest of us. You can't do that anymore. That's conflict, but it's healthy. And if it can be productive. But the point I wanted to make in The Last Dance is that Michael Jordan, all his teammates said, oh yeah, he winning was it. And if you fell behind at all, he got on you hard. And you fast forward decades later, Jordan is clearly emotionally pained by the fact that, yes, I won all those things. Now, I realize people view me in a negative way because of this strong desire. They feel like I was harsher on them than I needed to be. But, that's how I play the game. And if you don't want to play that game that way, then don't play.
Isn't it hard to agree with the GOAT, though? The greatest basketball of all time. So, wow, you don't agree with the way I am, but I won 6 championships. It's kind of like people like, well, JT, I don't agree your tie. Well, nobody's paying you $1 million a day. So I feel like in a way, or maybe the messages of the book, because as a high achiever myself, I saw things that obviously made complete sense and others, and maybe I'm fair, but it triggered me. I'm like, your desire to win, or unfortunately drama, every problem I have in my business has a first name, a last name. Right. And so by nature, humans are toxic, right? Relationships yes. distinguish it because people are disloyal. So, maybe we should redefine what your overall collective kind of message is, so that we don't like take straws and trying to nitpick this, sure. this phrase or not.
Let me frame it this way. So Jordan's goal was to win championships. He did it, and he did it better than anybody. One of the costs of doing that was today he doesn't have very good relationships with his former team members. They view him as a mean guy. But for Jordan, even to this day, even though it pains him that is true, it's still worth it.
You think it pains him, Ho? Do you really think it pains him? Because the dude's making $400 million on Nike, just made $3 billion setting his NFL team. Become very private, by the way. He's like the white whale I've been trying to get. Very hard. Doesn't want to do anything. Doesn't matter how much money you have. Still friends with Magic, not a good relationship with Barkley. Michael seemed to be very triggered that if someone says something negatively negative, just cuts you out as well. But in the back of your mind, you're still the GOAT. Like you could say the same thing about Bill Belichick, which is what we hear sometimes, former coach of the Patriots, worst coach I've ever had, but the guy won championships. Now the argument is how much of that was Brady or not. Obviously since Brady left, it hasn't been the same, but it seems that those people, we still talk about Scottie Pippen. We still talk about the Bulls team because of Michael Jordan. And without Michael Jordan, nobody would be even talking about those people. So it's just like when people attack other successful people that are highly driven and personality. And by the way, people who say bad things about Kobe Bryant, only now in his after death, people sort of, the mystique of him and Shaq didn't have the good relationship. I mean, is there such a thing? I mean, we hear actors, I could tell you some of the biggest names in the world, and on stage, they're like kind of nice, but backstage, some of the biggest assholes I've ever met. So, I like Ellen is the worst at treating people, yet, she was making $50 million a year or their show. Like I'm trying to figure out your premise. Well,
I'm not equating, it's horrible because I'm in venture capital, but I'm not equating money with success.
But isn't it a byproduct of like the more money you have, the more successful you are in theory? Maybe people have different definition. You're measured as venture capital. You are measured by
money,
by the wins you have. And of course in your business, you can have a lot of losses. Right. And so that's what I'm trying to figure out. Like, is your audience the high performance people like me? Or are we talking about to the general public who are just looking for an excuse why they haven't won? And so they can blame other people because they're bad and they're toxic.
No, my audience is anyone who on a regular basis works with, because as you said it, and I agree, human nature has the propensity to become toxic if left unchecked. I believe conflict is a very healthy driver of any worthwhile achievement, and that you cannot really achieve something that's remarkable or worthwhile without engaging in conflict. But there is healthy conflict and there's toxic conflict. Going back to the Jordan example, it wasn't toxic in the sense that he won all the championships he set out to win and he's the greatest of all time. It was toxic if his goal was to do that and have good friendships and relationships with his teammates. Could he have achieved both? I think so, but he didn't.
Jordan needed to create conflict. He needed to find an enemy in order to drive it. And by the way, I've been there before where I'll pick on something. I need an enemy just to keep me going, because when you have a lot of money, you have a lot of success. But I will agree with you, because you said earlier how you were 10 years ago is very different than you are today. I'm the same way too. And when I met Simon Cowell, it was the same thing too. I'm like, how come you're not, like, as I was hard charging, probably very toxic, but to me, if someone made a mistake, my partners would blame me. It's not, nobody cares. Oh, it wasn't me. It was the staff. It was the person. You're responsible. So when you have the weight on your shoulders, and you're only as good as your last deal, I had to keep pushing. And now I asked Simon Cowell, I said, why are you not the same as an American Idol one? You know what I mean? He goes, after a while, you just mature and you get tired of like, I disagree with you. Okay, next. You kind of become, so I'm a little bit sometimes like that. Once in a while, I'll have the switch, because it's exhausting to be arguing with people. And, your family, your friends tell you you're going to be a singer, you're amazing, or you're great. And then you show up and the expert, I'm going to prove you wrong. Because I find a lot of times the reason is that if everyone told you the truth, everyone here would listen, would be a millionaire, right? So what we do is, let's say you come on to me and say, I want to pitch to be on your show, right? And I'll be like, oh, I'm so sorry. I'm booked up, but check me next year. Rather than saying, I think your topic sucks. You're kind of boring. You're not going to be there. And if I said that, their defense mechanism, people like, no, like they would argue with you.
Yeah.
And it's just easier to just tell them, I'm booked, I'm not. And so what happens is that person, because they're not getting the straight truth, they go on pitch on the next podcast or the next deal over and over. As a venture capitalist, this is what happens, right? They go and pitch the next person. So they say, well, Gabe doesn't have the money to do, the deal. His firm is maxed out. But if you gave me that feedback about, like, I thought it was too good to be true, or your numbers, you're completely lying or whatever, then I can correct that on the next one. But people don't want confrontation, because it's easy just to blame somebody else, then deal it head on. And then people don't want to listen when there's confrontation. They argue, which creates more drama, which people don't want to deal with it. So isn't it a kind of like a catch-22?
I don't think so. I go with the tell them what, tell them why you're not investing in them. And we're very direct, and we try to be helpful to people. It's like, hey, look, based on your model, we don't see how you can get sufficient margins to make this successful. Like, we don't think you've solved that piece, but hey, keep working on it. And if you can prove out your theory, that'll overcome that hurdle for us. But until that happens, we're not going to invest. So you can say, there are many different ways to say that. You could say it like being a total jerk. You could kind of fluff and, give some flowery language that sort of skirts the issue. Or you can just go right at it and be direct and say, I'd love to invest in you. Like, you're a great guy. The model, it doesn't work for me. Like, I haven't, it hasn't been proved out. You also mentioned earlier, I want to talk about this. You said, like these winners, like Jordan, he needed to create this like enemy, so he could get it gave him the drive to go win. There's a great documentary. I can't remember if it was one of those ESPN ones, but it's Larry Bird and Magic. And Larry Bird hated Magic Johnson.
Bird versus Magic.
Bird versus Magic. Yeah. Okay. So he hates Magic, right? Like, professionally, personally, he couldn't distinguish any of that. Magic is like, yeah, on the court, he's going to go right at you. But personally, hey, let's hang out. And there's a great story in there, and you've seen it, I'm sure, is where they're shooting a commercial at Larry Bird's house for Converse on his parents' farm. And Magic is trying to talk to Larry, like, hey, man, like, between takes, he's like, let's hang out. And Bird's like, I don't like you. You're my enemy. And then apparently Larry Bird's mom, like, she made them sandwiches and had them come to the house. And they started to develop a relationship from there. But Bird had the thing that you're talking about, Jordan. It's like, I need this adversity and to create this toxicity in order for me to get the drive to win.
Keep winning. Isn't it not drive to win, but keep winning? I mean, I don't know if that was that drive that, like,
I would say that the people with like unending desire to win, they never feel like they've won. It's like you said before, what's your favorite win? It's the one I haven't gotten yet. So while on paper, you know, they look like they're really successful and they're winning, they should be happy. Inside, they feel like, no, I'm not done yet. I haven't actually achieved. I haven't got to the point where I said, okay, I did it. Because it never stops. But, you know, in terms of success, it's how you define it. I would say this. There are a lot of people that would rather be right, would rather win than be happy. So they go through life winning. Like you said, they have like, they argue with their family. They argue with their friends. They just, everything's an argument. And they always just got to win that argument. And you know, they piss people off around them. And they aren't happy. They may feel their self-esteem may be satisfied because they feel like they're winning all the time. But there's a cost to that from a relationship standpoint. And there are people that don't care. And those people that don't care about that cost, hey, God bless you. You know, you're being you. You're being the best version of you. So other people may say, well, he's toxic, but he, if this he we're talking about doesn't value having personal relationships that are deep, there's no harm to him. Like, it's not a bad thing in that scenario. So it's all about framing.
So the premise of your book, Don't Be Bad at Penguins. I thought penguins are like happy feet and happy. Like, is that just a clever marketing a tool that you have? Or was there a point to be made, you know, for the audience listening? Because I don't know. I always thought, I saw the Disney movie. I don't know if it's Disney, but it's Happy Feet. I mean, penguins are like nice. I mean, I've never had anything bad to say about a penguin.
They look cute. They look cuddly.
Yeah, they are cute.
There's a chapter that says, don't get mad at penguins because they can't fly. And long before I decided to write the book, in mentoring people and just working with people, I saw a repeating pattern that of frustration and unhappiness that people were having. And it always was, regardless of the details, a statement to the effect of, you know, I deal with this person and they always do this, or they never do that. And it happens over and over again. And it pisses me off every time. And they know it pisses me off and they keep doing it. And that makes me even more pissed off. And I would dig into that and say, well, do you think that they're just like trying to piss you off? And the next time that you have an interaction with them, do you think they're going to do it again? Yeah, they're going to do it again. Okay. So then why would you get mad at that? Like, that's just how they are. Maybe they can't even help it. Maybe they're not even aware of it, or to the extent they are aware of it, they don't have the tools to behave in the way that you want. So if you get angry with somebody because they're not doing things that they're literally not capable of doing, that's kind of wasted. That's like getting mad at a penguin because it can't fly. And the reason that I use the penguin analogy is that a lot of times it's actually hard to see someone's limitations. It's like, oh, wait, this is a fully formed human being. They're smart, they're clever, they're witty. So therefore, they must also be able to do the thing that I want them to do. But the reality is they can't do it. They have limitations.
So let me use this argument, which is this. President of the United States, Biden and Trump. A president really doesn't have that much power in the scheme of things. Things have to go through Congress. Yeah, they got veto power. So people will be mad at Trump or Biden or any of their political leaders, but they really don't have the power to change, because it'll be like so-and-so administration, but there's only so much power. And I think the president is usually a figurehead. So why are people mad about something that really, they really can't do anything with them, because it's either Congress or the laws have to be passed, or they don't have the power just to change the law like that. But then people are mad at them, blame them, everything, and go out of their way to talk bad or that. So how does that apply to, say, public figures of in politics?
Yeah, I mean, the public figure thing is a little different, but I would say that that people are angry with Biden or angry with Trump for the same reason that Patriots fans are angry with Dolphins fans. Very tragic thing happened over the weekend, you know, but someone...
I thought it was a first down, but what do I know?
So, but the, you know, the point is that it's like tribal mentality at its base level. I think that's what's going on. You know, if you're, you know, people that are like even moderately focused on politics, when they engage in this tribal mentality, if I make some statement that suggests that I have a specific opinion on a very specific political point or policy, you know, the a person who's like tribal in that way would just therefore assume that I have a whole bunch of other political views that I very well may not have, but it's like, oh, well, you're one of those people. That means, you know, ultimately it's the same thing, right? That means you don't care about the country. You want to destroy our society and you want to use the political system to drive that down. And the leader of your movement is Trump. So they're, because you said like they're really figureheads. Well, yeah, they are figureheads, and they're figureheads for those tribes as well.
So isn't it the title, if you had probably rebranded the book, Millionaires Don't Get Mad at Penguins, because a millionaire knows people's limitations. They know what they can and cannot do. And if not, they'll go find some other animal to be able to fly, and they won't dwell on the fact that penguins can't fly and blame the penguin for their problems. They'll just go create their own economy. Would that be a fair assessment?
Yeah, I mean, I don't really agree with the premise that all millionaires, you know, have that ability. But I think that the people
you've had to, at some point, you have to agree, because you don't, unless you were lucky, which there's a element of luck, is that, you know, in business, you need the right people in the right position, doing the right things with the right information, right? And so,
yes.
So bottom line is, you can't, if you have penguins and you want to fly and they can't fly, it doesn't matter how bad you want them to fly, it's not going to happen. So if you don't have the foresight to find other animals and say, okay, the penguins are good at this, right? And maybe I need some flamingos or that look good, but they fly a little bit. And then I mean a couple eagles, and those are harder to find. Like, the premise is that most people maybe not be successful because they keep blaming the penguin or their circumstances. Like, you want a Tesla car, you want to drive from Orlando to Miami, and you want a Tesla, but let's say there's no charging station. The car is not going to get you to Miami unless you charge. So right. It doesn't matter how much you want the car and how much you like the car and how much you're passionate about a car, or it's not going to get you there. So maybe you need a BMW i8, which is part hybrid, part this. And so it's like people, I need to love what I do. I want to be a millionaire. Well, it doesn't matter what you do. This idea is not going to make you millions no matter what you do. So no matter how much you love it, how much you're passionate about it, and maybe it's because they have a lot of penguins in there and they don't realize that they need other things than penguins. Maybe I've redefined the premise of your book. By the way, that'll be that is going to be the headline of this podcast.
I think you've hit it. It's really the people that waste time trying to make something happen that is impossible to happen, or get someone to do something that they can't do, yet they continue to try to get them to do it. That's the suffering that the book is designed to eliminate. Because the hardest part is realizing and understanding does have that limitation. And the penguin thing is what confuses you. It's like, well, wait, what do you mean a penguin can't fly? It's a bird. It's got wings. It's got feathers. And birds with wings and feathers can fly. Except that penguins can't. All other birds can, but not penguins. So the idea here is that, wait, this person I've got on my team, I needed them to deal with the client and do handle it this way. And you know, they're really competent over here on this other area. So for sure, they're competent in this area as well. And they have failed. And that's because they chose to fail. And they're doing it to spite me, or they're doing it because they're lazy, or fill in the blank, whatever it is. So if you continue working with that person to try to get them to fly and they literally can't fly, you're just wasting time. So the really successful people don't spend time in that space. They're able to assess, okay, clearly what I've asked this person to do, it's beyond their limitations. So I'm not going to ask them to do it anymore. I'm going to find someone who can. But the penguins are really good.
Is there an expectation that that maybe rather than blaming the penguin, they had to look at themselves first of all? And the problem is they keep blaming everybody else other than themselves. So it's like you're blaming someone and you're not taking personal accountability to become a better leader, because you're just blaming, I have shitty people working for me. I live in this part of the world. I live in this mentality. Like, you know, Australia, you have top poppy syndrome, places, Scandinavia, other mentalities, Yang Talagen, which is don't be better than anybody else, right? So I lived in a different environment, but is it maybe because people are blaming their environment and are not changing their own circumstances? Is that another lesson possibly?
Absolutely. And I think it's not only blaming your own environment, it's there's a defense mechanism there. It's like, well, I hired this person so they could do this task. If they can't do this task, that means I did a bad job of hiring. I then have to acknowledge that I failed in selecting this person. And sometimes for people, it's hard for them to admit that. It's a self-esteem thing. That's one thing.
Isn't part also with the pandemic? At this point, we take a look at it. The fact that we have, you know, the virus is still around, and we're not shutting down and still there. People still going to the hospital, not at the degree it did, is that we live in a society that if the politicians came out and say, hey, we're sorry, we shouldn't have done this. Here's the lessons we learned. Here's how to make sure we're not going to do it again. And I remember when I started my business, if you were wrong, you just say I'm wrong and you just don't repeat the same mistake twice. But today, society, we don't admit that we're wrong because people will be using it against you because we don't forgive. We just use against. So people deny, deny, deny. And as a result, nothing changes. And all it creates is a disparity of power, of anger, that in a way, you know, if they say, fine, we are wrong, be like, I told you so. And then it'll just keep rubbing in their face, which might not get people reelected or might not even get future jobs. And so better to deny and not be take personal responsibility, because that way, you know, your whole life or brand is destroyed. So isn't that part of the problem?
It's part of the problem. I make a big distinction between politics and almost everything else, because the goal for politicians is just to get more votes. And the reality is most people who are casting those votes aren't making really informed decisions. They're basically deciding who they for because they like, they, oh, I like the way this person talks. In business and in lots of other areas of life, it's more personal. In other words, you know a lot more. So people are making much more informed decisions. So when somebody, like you said, well, if somebody admits they're wrong, it's just going to be used against them. I believe you can remove that ability for someone to use it against you. If I say, hey, look, I screwed this up. You're goddamn right. You screwed that up. You just say, and I just say, yeah, I screwed it up. This is what I did wrong. This is why I did it wrong. Here's how I'm going to fix it. Here's what I'm going to do to make it better. Okay, fine. But you screwed up. Yes.
I use the exact same line, especially with kids, right? If they just admitted they were wrong. I think the excuse sometimes is worse than the actual reason why they failed, because all you just want them to say is I messed up. But there's also people on the other side. They're wrong all the time. Oh yeah, I'm sorry. And after a while you're like, okay, enough with your sorry.
That's annoying.
Right. Yeah, that's also, there's a byline on that, because some people thrive on that, which is another form of conflict, right? Where you're just enabling, isn't it? Whatever you enable, you tolerate in a way. And that's part of the problem in society. We just tolerate it. And then in fact, we're enabling it. We're mad about it, but we don't do anything because we don't want a conflict.
Right. People instinctively kind of run from the conflict. You know, when you've done something wrong and you won't admit it, you're now creating a whole new thing that the other person's like, what? You're not admitting it. Now they're not even focused on whatever it needs to be accomplished. They're now focused on, I can't move forward until you admit what you were wrong. Like, I'm not going to pretend. I'm not going to let you pretend that you didn't screw this thing up. And now progress has just come to a screeching halt because they got this BS like issue that no one even cares about in the big picture. The people in business, they just want to move forward. I mean, the most successful business people I've encountered, one thing they all have in common, I think this is kind of what you were getting to before about recognizing penguins. They just, when mistakes are made, they just move past them. Like they're in the rearview mirror so fast. It's like, sure, they could spend time blaming, they could spend time apologizing, but they just move ahead. It's like, that thing, wait, are you talking about that thing from like 2 days ago? That was like 2 days ago. We're talking about this thing now. Like, yeah, I screwed that up. Fine. Yeah, he screwed that up. Who cares? We're dealing with now. That's because those people don't waste time and energy on this toxic crap where you're not making progress.
First of all, we should rebrand the book. Millionaires don't get mad at penguins because they're eagles. So that'd be the subtitle too, because at the end of the day, you can't get mad at people who are not, that they are what they are. And as an entrepreneur, you have to fly higher than all the rest. So if you know, phenomenal interview. What is there a website, or obviously the book is Don't Get Mad at Penguins. Is there a website where people, I referred to your website with a lot of different traits, on that you can read out, very informative, good looking website.
Can you give us that website name? GabeCarp.com.
And then Carp pick up the book. And if they pick up the book, what is the one key, obviously this is an entrepreneur show, that you think they're going to get the most out of reading your book?
I think my hope is that people aren't afraid of conflict for they to read the book, that to the, that that they view conflict not as a bad thing that they should figure out how to avoid, but rather something that they should engage in and go after, and view conflict as an opportunity to improve a customer relationship, improve the performance of a team member, innovate faster. Like anytime there's a conflict that feels uncomfortable, that is an opportunity. And the people that lean into it, they move faster and they do better.
Last question.
So that's my hope.
Walter Isaacson, who did the book on Elon Musk, said that Elon Musk was a person who's like, if everything goes well, he needs to create drama, whatever that drama is. And also too, he was addicted to drama and addicted to risk. Now, we can sit here and criticize. He's still the wealthiest man in the world. So how do you, that theory fits into your equation?
There are people who are addicted to drama and addicted to risk that are just massive failures. So those characteristics don't determine success or failure. They're insufficient to determine it. Now, being averse to risk, like being afraid of risk, that's going to really hurt you in success. You got to take a risk. Yeah.
What's interesting you just said about that is people say, I want to start an app. And but as a VC, you hear it all the time. And they say, well, Uber did it. And they're like, but they still lose money. Or this company did it. And so they look at the one exception rather than the norm. And it'd be very interesting how many people were addicted to risk or addicted to success. And you've seen this before. They make a lot of money and they lose it all. And some make it back and some never make it again, right? And so because obviously it's the equivalent of all of a sudden it's on top of the world. You know, I'm sitting in business class, hypothetically, or first class, and all of a sudden now I'm at the back of the plane, middle seat next to the bathroom. And all I could think is, I used to be on there. I used to be there. And that mindset that got them there is not going to get them out of there because there's a different mentality and they're operating from a modus of entitlement that I used to be there. Thoughts?
Yeah, entitlement is just an annoying, useless thing. It can be helpful in that it can drive behavior. But I know guys that have been like way up and just flying first class, flying private, and then they're way down because they're just always engaging in risk. I think as someone who spent a lot of time with founders and startup execs and people building companies, one of the characteristics that is critically important and is a differentiator is that you take risks, but when you're starting up a company, you're going to be running at 100 miles an hour and you're going to run right into a brick wall at 100 miles an hour. And the people with the passion and the resilience and the drive to just get up and start running again as fast as they possibly can, and you know, have some moderately good instincts, they're the ones that innovate. They're the ones that aren't going to get, because there are a lot of people, most people, you run into a brick wall at 100 miles an hour and you fall down. A lot of people don't get up. They're like, I'm not going to run anymore. I'm just going to walk. I'm going to take it easy. Those people aren't going to succeed. It's the ones that say, that wake up in the morning saying, I'm not doing this business because I think it's going to be this awesome thing. I'm doing this business because I can't not do this business. I don't know how to live my life without making this vision that I have a reality. And I don't care what gets in my way. I'm going to either run through that wall, I'll run around that wall, I'll innovate. It's going to happen. That drive is critically important. And by the way, the book, I think one of the things I hope is that people can get from the book is that you can have that drive and also not piss everybody off around you and not, you know, churn out a bunch of employees who think that you're an asshole. It's like, I don't want to work for this freaking guy. He's too he's so focused on driving. He doesn't care about any of us.
So you and I talked literally only 60 seconds before we got the interview. My people set this up and clearly we've been going there. What was your impression? And you'll be completely honest with you. I could take it. I'm an eagle. That should be your next book. Like, you know, there's got to be like the eagle. What animal are you? I think I'm a killer shark based on a previous podcast we did. So what did you think about me? Like when you did the research before, obviously coming onto the show versus what do you think of the interview here today? Just very curious about your thought process.
Yeah. So, this is more business focused than I thought it would be, which is great. I love that. Because I saw you do some interviews. You know, I saw Mark Wahlberg and, you know, sort of like more of the entertainment type stuff. Yeah.
Well, I wasn't going to dress as a penguin, although that could have been a segment. If it was live, I'd come out as a penguin and that would be a good live moment. But
that'd have been a great moment. It would have been better if we could get like a
we're making that happen. Maybe I'll come out dressed as like a penguin and I'll go viral. For some reason, people don't remember my interview with Wahlberg. They remember me dressed as Transformer. They remember me dressed like Braveheart. And they remember doing Grease. Funny enough, nobody remembers the actual interview. They remember the I was all
the content of the interview.
What do you think of the of me now?
I like you. I think it's engaging. I enjoy the conversation. I actually want to I could talk about this stuff.
This could have been a 4-hour. It would still be going. And we just scratched the surface as well. No,
yeah, I mean,
I knew within the first 60, at the 10 seconds of you speaking, I'm like, yeah, this is going to be good. But also too, as a former trial attorney, you know, the gift of the gab and the, you know, there's a level of showmanship per se that is required. And not everyone can be a trial lawyer. A lot of people like you tend to be the really crappy research lawyer. And I would be a crappy research lawyer because I just can't, just give me the case and then I will write. But you need those people to do the research, because no matter how good you are as a trial lawyer, if there's no case basis to your argument, you're going to lose. You can bullshit. I'd be like, great speech, but that's not the law. So there is by the way, that's a perfect example of knowing that, hey, I'm an eagle in terms of trial lawyer, but I need the penguins to do the work, to be there to set the premise. And so, you know, we all have penguins in our lives, and it's not a negative thing, because without the penguin in our businesses or lives, we can't get certain things accomplished, because there is no person that could do everything.
Yeah. I mean, I actually love the research part of it too. And I like writing legal briefs. What, you know, it's interesting. I'm going to take this back to kind of a business thing. As in a company where I was, you know, startup, we grew really big. I built up a legal team. And I hired lawyers and I hired non-lawyers to do lawyer work. So here's an interesting issue that I find a lot of people have, and I experienced it. I believe, because there's ego, I could draft a better document than anyone else can. And I would spend time drafting a document, yet I'm leading an entire team and there are people whose job it is to draft the document. If I'm spending time drafting a document because I'm thinking I'm going to do it better than someone on my team, I'm wasting time. What I really needed to be doing and started doing is the thing that no one else in the building could do. So I had to accept the fact that, you know what, I don't like the syntax of the sentence and how it flows, like, you know, for the 2% of people that would appreciate what I would have done in this, it's not important from a business standpoint. What's important is that this thing gets done and out the door. And the person that I've got on my team is very good at doing it. The fact that I could do it better is irrelevant. I need to let go of that. So I find a lot of leaders have trouble letting go and just delegating, knowing that they're handing a task off to someone who's not going to do it as well as they can, but the opportunity cost of doing it instead of this person on your team is huge, because something that no one in the company can do is not being done because I'm spending time drafting some document. I got to let go of that. That's a
micromanaging. We have to do a part two. We have to do a part two, part three of this interview, because it was actually, we're just scratched the surface. So it could be, make sure you pick up the book, and I'm sure you can reach out to Gabe on his LinkedIn and send him a message and tell him what you thought of this interview as well. And by the way, please share this interview. This is one of the great interviews as well. Make sure you subscribe, you share, you review. We gave an hour of value here at no charge. All we ask is that you just click the like button or share, or just give it a review and pass it on, because we can inspire more people and have great debates like we have. That is Gabe Carr, everybody. We'll see you on the next show.